This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Network. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Network does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Advancing the Science of Addiction, brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. I'm your host, Jimmy Alexander, and today we have the privilege once again of speaking to Dr. Nicholas Christian, MD, MBA, who serves as staff clinician in the Office of the Clinical Director at the NIDAIRP. Dr. Christian, thank you so much for joining us again, and I promise that's the last time I'll call you Dr. Christian.
Thank you, Jimmy. Yes, please call me Dr. Nick. Have to say doctor, welcome to just say Nick. But it's so great to be back. Thank you.
We appreciate your time. We know you're very busy. And as you know, the president of the NIDA IRP fan club, Bethesda chapter, as I am, yeah. I know you guys are doing so much work and I know you're busy. So I appreciate you finding time for all
you
of us
today.
You
are the number one fan of that fan club. We appreciate it, Jimmy.
Well, to start off, could you please tell everyone what is NIDA IRP? And what do you guys do there?
Yeah, so the NIDA is the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We are a part of the National Institutes on Health, so we're one of the divisions that does research to advance our understanding of addiction and drug use. And what we do at the IRP, which stands for the Intramural Research Program, we are located in Baltimore, and some of the government funding stays internal, and so we are a federal organization that focuses on doing drug use research in the Baltimore area. A lot of our research is what we call preclinical, so doing things that don't necessarily relate to humans, so looking at the behavior of rodents or studying cells, that sort of preclinical work. But our research also spans all the way up to we provide treatment for certain conditions and see how it works in people's lives. So we currently have trials that are ongoing that are recruiting people who either smoke or have alcohol use or opioid use or cocaine use. And we welcome members of the community to participate in our studies and not only participate in our studies, but also help us in our research to make sure that we are answering the questions that the community wants answered. So we have other methods like an advisory board and other means to really understand what are the needs of the community and how is it that together we can work together to advance the science of addiction.
Now, I know, Dr. Nick, that you went to a school that is known as the Ohio State University.
Yes, thank you for getting the royal V.
Absolutely. And you got your degree in?
In Spanish.
Spanish. Adios mio, and that's all I have. That's all I have, to be honest with you, Doc. I apologize.
That's great.
That's all I got. But, because I heard that so often when I would talk to somebody who spoke Spanish. They'd look at me and go, adios mio. But you also... you went to medical school, and then you went in Texas?
Yes. So I did my internal medicine training. Internal medicine is just medicine for adults. And after that, I did additional training in what we call addiction medicine. So that's a fellowship. Usually it's a one-year clinical fellowship where you get a lot of hands-on experience treating people with addiction. And there are also pathways where as long as you're in a care setting where you're seeing a high volume of people with addiction, you don't necessarily have to complete a fellowship. You can tally up your hours working with that population, and you can get this credential that's called a board certification in addiction medicine.
Now, did you do that in New Haven or is that in Austin?
So I did my addiction medicine fellowship at the program in addiction medicine at Yale in New Haven, Connecticut. And I completed a one-year clinical fellowship there, as well as hung around and did a little bit of research and clinical training at the Department of Veterans Affairs there for a year.
Oh, again, talking about doing the work for the good, I mean, doing that, that had to be quite inspiring.
Oh, very insightful. I was able to be a part of a care team there called the HPACT, which stands for the Homeless Patient Aligned Care Team, where we provided care for people who are veterans who were once unhoused that are were transitioning out of homelessness.
What would you say the age group that you treated there or you met with?
Among veterans, it definitely was an older population. I would say ranging from 30s up until 70s. In fact, I think I even had one patient who was encroaching 90 years of age, and he was still walking to the clinic, and he would walk like 10 miles to get to our clinic. It was remarkable.
Oh, my gosh. So he was probably in World War II.
Yeah, I believe the Korean.
The Korean War. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Amazing. Yeah.
Talking about somebody who inspiring in so many different ways.
Absolutely.
So that probably with you, Doc, I mean, if he's walking all that way at 90 years old, you can't call in going, I don't feel well today. I think
no.
I have a sinus infection.
I bike to work 2.5 miles and I still complain about it. So that's
Dr. Nick, I think you are where I come from called a do-gooder.
Yeah.
You're trying to help everybody and the environment.
Well, try, but I'm still not walking 15 miles a day.
Right? No,
and like you said, as I've heard you say before, like we often can complain about the little things,
yes,
and forget the big picture. Yeah,
absolutely,
what other people are going through.
And hear that somebody's walking 15 miles who's 90 and was in the Korean War, it totally has to make you feel like I have made the right decision in a career path.
Yes, absolutely.
Now,
absolutely.
You told us before about a doctor who inspired you to go into this line of work. Do you mind just telling us about that one more time?
Yeah, so I helped set up a mobile health clinic in this Latino trailer park. I was translating some of their handouts. And in the process, I saw this doctor who was really heading up this process of getting this clinic off the ground. And I got to watch him interact with patients, and I was just really inspired by his humility and being a part of the community and developing these services to get people the care that they need. That was just the first time I had ever seen a doctor in that setting. And that's definitely been something that I have tried to keep with me in my practice of medicine is how is it that we can make our services more accessible to members of the community? And how is it that we can allow ourselves to be changed by people who are experiencing these disease processes that we're treating. Because I think it's so important. Science creates so much amazing, innovative, groundbreaking knowledge that we can use to help develop treatments and help develop different therapies that we can use to help treat people with addiction. But unless we really understand how those treatments are being taken up by the community, those treatments can sometimes be siloed and not be available to members of the community. And so that's definitely been an area of interest of mine and an area of interest, not only in my clinical practice, but in my research as well.
And then when you moved to Austin, Texas, you found yourself in a community quite like the one that you had been helping in Ohio.
Yeah, not that different, just much larger.
Yes.
This was a community called Community First Village. They're housing people in tiny homes and in RVs. I believe they have provided housing to over 500 people who were once unhoused in Austin. And they have the goal of housing up to 1,500 in the next 3 years. Just an amazing organization that's really transforming a lot of people's lives. And yeah, you're right. Being exposed to that original community, helping start that clinic, definitely, I think, made my palate more open to living in a community like that. And I lived there for—
How old were you when you first helped that community in Ohio or were translating?
Oh, man, that must have been probably 25 years. No, probably younger than that, 22, I would say.
You couldn't even rent a car at that point.
Couldn't.
Not that
no.
You would because you have a bike. But nevertheless, and that changed your life. I just think that's wonderful that moment changed the course of your whole life.
Absolutely. And there's been a lot of a lot of things that, in hindsight, I think really got me very interested in treating addiction. Having lost a couple of close friends, a musician friend of mine who we recorded music together, he unfortunately died prematurely of an overdose, a presumed overdose. And having just known his heart and his inspiration, and seeing just how challenging it was for him and his family to talk about his addiction and to talk about his treatment, I think that he very much was in a shell and felt shelled off from the rest of the world. And I think that part of that fueled him being unable to get the treatment that he really needed. And living through that and seeing him and loving him and losing him, I think all of that definitely changed my view of addiction and no longer viewing it as a decision that someone makes. If we just accept people for who they are and we start to understand that these decisions that people make aren't just decisions, that these are these are triggers, that there's an addictive process that really changes the anatomy of our brains in a way that we're not making the best decisions for ourselves. And if we can accept people in their current state and allow them the opportunity to engage in care, to engage in treatment, I think that we could build a better world for people.
Well, thank you, Dr. Nick. And coming up, you'll find out what is an addiction doctor. That's next here on Advancing the Science of Addiction.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
We're back here on Advancing the Science of Addiction. I'm Jimmy Alexander, along with Dr. Nick Christian. Now, Dr. Nick, I think a lot of us wonder when we hear this, addiction medicine doctor. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, so typically it's a physician or anymore the field of addiction medicine isn't just doctors. It's also advanced practice providers. It's anyone that has taken a particular interest in addiction, usually coming from a background of doing either internal medicine or emergency medicine or any other larger field of medicine. You usually complete just your medical school training and your residency, and then you can do additional training on what's the best way to treat people with what we call a substance use disorder. And so these are people that have gotten additional training or additional exposure. And oftentimes it's a board certified credentialing process that you can go through.
Dr. Nick, when you walked into medical school for the first day to the time that you were certified as an addiction medicine doctor, how long of a period was that, would you say?
So medical school is 4 years, and then usually you do a residency training program. So I did internal medicine, and that's at least a minimum of 3 years. I did a chief resident year because I enjoy teaching. So that's a total of already I'm at 7 years. And then usually people do their fellowship right after their residency training, and that's an additional year traditionally.
So total?
A total of at least 8 years.
Oh, Mike. Now, I don't know if you know, but the broadcasting school I went to was not that long. But nevertheless,
it's hard to
but when we talk about being an addiction medicine doctor, what are some of the tools in the tool belt that you are using?
Yeah, I think that tool number one is making people feel welcome in our care environment. A lot of times people living with substance use or with an addiction, they don't feel comfortable in our care environments. And sometimes just extending a helping hand, actually listening to people, asking them about their lives, that alone sometimes can be therapeutic for people. And the goal is really to establish a relationship in which you can see this individual over an extended period of time.
Where you do build a relationship of trust, non-judgment, because I know even a doctor, and not that we all say we lie to our doctors, but we might not tell them the whole truth.
You know,
like your doctor says, you know, well, how much do you weigh? And you go, well, you know, I think I weigh this. And you know good and well that you weigh a little more than that, but you don't want them to stand, you don't want to stand on a scale in front of 15 people.
Oh, yeah.
And I would imagine that with that, and also with doctors, because I'm sure anytime somebody finds out you're a doctor, it's like, well, hello. I mean, now I would never call you Nick. It's got to be Dr. Nick because you're a doctor. You went to doctor school and to have that courtesy. And I know that doctors say that a lot of times it's maybe like a priest. A priest, it's like once you find out someone's a priest, you're treating them differently than you would, you know, than if they were just like Phil.
Yeah, that's very, yeah.
Do you deal with that where you're like, I'm going to have to talk to me like I'm just Nick?
I think that I do try to introduce myself by my first name to a lot of my patients if they feel comfortable doing so, not as a cheap way to show that I'm on their level, but as one first step to signify that, you know what, this care environment might be a little different than the care environments you've been in before, and I want you to feel comfortable here, and I want you to know that I view you as the expert of your own health. That I am, yes, I'm an expert in medicine. Yes, I did years and years of training to understand the science of medicine and what medications are best in which conditions. But you are the only one that's going to be able to make behavior change in your life. And so that is a core principle of what we in the field call motivational interviewing, which is really an approach to listening to patients and acknowledging that they are the expert of their own health. The term actually motivational interviewing comes from this idea that like, who are the people that we interview most often? Usually we interview experts. We interview people that are the best in their field, with the exception of this podcast, of course. I'm not the best in my field. But in most instances, that's who we are interviewing. And so the concept of motivational interviewing is to listen to individuals, acknowledge that they are the expert in their health, and help guide them towards what it is that how can they achieve the goals that they want to unleash their potential.
And you also would have imagined would have to build trust and where they're not feeling judged, because you want them to be as honest, 100% honest, because how can they really get help or really make any kind of progress if you as the doctor don't know the whole story?
Exactly. Most clinicians, I think when you hear a patient say, oh, yeah, I have roughly 2 drinks a week, usually they say you need to multiply that by 5 or multiply it by some number.
Have you talked to my doctor?
True.
What's going on here, Dr.
No,
Neck?
I have not.
I don't get what's going on here.
But all that to say, I am not the police. Like, I'm not here to determine exactly how much someone is drinking or using. I really, if I'm asking the question, it's because I'm curious, and it's because I'm curious because it might change our treatment strategy. And there's something in the field that actually came out of some of the psychedelic research of the 50s and 60s. And it's this concept called drug set and setting. And it's an approach to think about, all right, what is the drug that someone is using? What is the mindset that someone is using, that someone has when they're using their substance? And what is the setting in which they are using the substance? And really, unless you understand all of those things, the drug, the mindset, and the setting, it's hard to create a comprehensive care plan for people. Because for a lot of people, it might be the environment that they're living, the setting that actually is triggering for them. They associate drug use in this environment. For instance, going to a bar, we often associate that with drinking alcohol. That can be a hard thing to break for some people. And so all of this to say that it's important to understand someone's holistic environment and what their living situation is often like, Because without knowing these contextual factors, I can prescribe medications all day, but the medications likely aren't going to be effective alone. It's going to require addressing more than just prescribing a medication in my visit with them. So I really try to make patients feel comfortable when I'm asking them questions, and make sure that they understand that I'm asking them from a place of genuine curiosity, because this will help me care for you better.
My personality is, if I talk to somebody about their life, just how my memory is, I will remember the details of that conversation for the rest of my life. How do you protect yourself for not, protect yourself in like, oh my gosh, these stories, or oh my gosh, this person, you want to help them, and where you're not just going home and not being able to sleep, worrying about everybody?
Yeah, that's very tough. I feel like I struggled early on, because I think originally in medical training, we're taught that the doctor prescribes the medications, the patient takes the medications. If the medication doesn't work, then you think about other medications to potentially prescribe.
I think that's like the first 15 minutes of every House ever watched.
Exactly. The reality is that doctors, we might prescribe medications, but we're not there to put the pill in people's mouths.
Yeah.
People, even just taking a basic medication for high blood pressure requires behavior change. You have to change your routine to actually take that medication. And I think acknowledging that behavior change is hard is really important. And so I used to get worked up when patients weren't taking their medications. Like, what are you doing? Why aren't you taking the medicine I'm prescribing? And I realized, you know what? There's only so much about someone's care that I contribute to. And actually, we think that from studies that really only about 10% of someone's health is dictated by their doctor. That's kind of a humbling number. Like, the majority of someone's health is actually their lifestyle and the environment in which they're living. And so learning these facts, I think, help humble me a little bit in realizing that I am not the police. I'm not here to determine and scold you for taking a medication or not. I'm here to meet you where you're at. And if you're not ready to take a medication, that's fine. Let's talk about other things that we can do to help you in your treatment and in your care plan.
Well, that's really interesting, because I know that because I know it's tough, and I can tell you're a very caring person. So I know that you've probably had many, many restless nights over this. But when we come back here on Advancing the Science of Addiction, you'll find out how they treat addiction at NIDA IRP.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Thanks for hanging around with us here on Advancing the Science of Addiction. I'm Jimmy Alexander here with Dr. Nick. Now, Dr. Nick, everyone over at the NIDA IRP, you're doing clinical studies, you're doing treatment to help people battle addiction. And I know this may sound like the most simplistic question in the world, but how do you treat addiction?
That is a great question. If we had a 100% correct answer, I think that we wouldn't be seeing, I think in 2023, there were nearly 110,000 overdose deaths. So we are still developing that science and still figuring out which medications, which therapies are best for people. But I always think of it as kind of a smorgasbord. There's a lot of different treatment options, and different flavors work for different people depending on their backgrounds. The number one thing I think is people need to have some sort of relationship with either a therapist or a doctor or some provider that they feel comfortable talking to. I think without having access to care, you aren't aware of what you don't know about the science of addiction. And so I think that that's ingredient number one is connection to a provider. We also have tons of medications that are highly, highly effective. These are medications with what we call in the field a number needed to treat. Like, so you need to treat a certain number of people before someone benefits. The benefit of some of these medicines are just like antidepressant medications for depression. So these are effective medications that just haven't been prescribed traditionally as much as they should. For alcohol use disorder, for instance, one of the medications is called naltrexone. And it's been in studies shown to be highly effective at reducing the number of heavy drinking days that people experience if they have an alcohol use disorder. The other FDA-approved medications for alcohol include disulfiram and acamprosate. And then there are a couple of other off-label medications that we use for alcohol in some situations. So that's alcohol. For opioid use disorder, there are three medications that are FDA approved. One is also naltrexone, which is a full opioid blocker. We have a medication called buprenorphine. The trade name is Suboxone. That's a partial opioid blocker. And then we also have methadone, which is a full opioid, what we call agonist, that activates the receptor fully. All three of them are shown to save lives. And when I'm talking save lives, I'm talking like one in three people that are treated on these things. If we treat three people, we're preventing one overdose.
Oh, my gosh.
They're life-saving. And we know this, but for some reason, it's been really hard to mobilize getting people access to this treatment. And so that's opioid use disorder. We also have a couple of medications that look like they have some efficacy for cocaine use, for stimulant use disorder. But then we start to open up a whole nother category of treatments that we call psychotherapies. There are things like cognitive behavioral therapy that's highly effective. There are also other therapies that are more effective even than the current medications that we have for people who use stimulants. And one of those therapies that I get really excited about is called contingency management. And the way that contingency management works is it provides people with immediate incentives or rewards. Most often that's either money or gift cards. And it provides those rewards for people if they do certain behaviors. So if they either provide a negative urine drug screening or use the substance less, you reward the behavior that you're trying to reinforce.
And has that been effective?
It's incredibly effective. It's the most effective treatment that we have for stimulant use.
Wow.
And it was recently California just rolled out access to contingency management in their Medi-Cal program. So I'm very excited to look at the data to see how that has worked rolling it out.
Dr. Nick, why do you think that is? Why is that more powerful than another with stimulants compared to drinking or anything else?
So the one thing I'll even go very broad with that question, Jimmy, if you don't mind. So the addictive process usually starts with something that creates an immediate increase in our dopamine. Dopamine is very rewarding. It's released with every hit of a cigarette, usually with every use of just about any substance, even things like a like on your Instagram. Like when you look at your phone and see that, the reason that feels good is because you're releasing some dopamine. As that dopamine wears off, oftentimes, and we don't have the immediate reward of use. So that's the first step of the addictive process is reward. Once that wears off, we go through a phase that we call withdrawal. And that doesn't feel good. Usually that's associated with increase in our stress hormones, which ends up leading us to be very preoccupied with figuring out how we can feel good again. And not feeling good leads you into this preoccupation phase, which leads you back into what we call the binge phase or the reward phase. And the more that we exercise that cycle, binge, withdrawal, preoccupation with use, the more that that circle goes around, the more permanent this neurocircuitry and stable that circuitry becomes in our brain.
I mean, it sounds like chaos.
It's predicted chaos in our brain. And studies at the NIDA, IRP have shown these processes that are happening in our brains. And so why is it that we don't have good medications for stimulant use, for instance? Stimulants are really good at flooding our brains with dopamine as compared to some of the other substances that people use. And because that massive amount of dopamine is released, we are having a hard time figuring out medications that can target that process. For instance, if we block the dopamine receptor, which we have tried to do, that can cause a lot of problems in people's lives because we're dependent on dopamine in our daily life. That's why you and I show up to work every day, every time we get a paycheck, every time we see our loved ones, every time we greet our pet at the door. That's dopamine to some degree. And so we are dependent on it to live a fulfilling life. And if you block that response, that can be problematic for people in their lives. And so we don't have a good medication that can target that process, the huge rush of dopamine that happens with stimulants. However, even though we can't combat that huge rush and that huge reward, we can try to provide people with a different reward, an immediate reward, just as immediate as their drug use. And that immediate reward, when we provide people with the opportunity to potentially earn a little bit of cash or earn a gift card,
cash is much better than a like on Instagram.
Exactly. If you can offer that, you are in delivering that immediate reward because people chose not to use, you are able to break up the addictive process that's happening, and you're providing them with a different reward and engaging the individual, and the individual has the opportunity then to put a little money in their pocket, to start to view themselves in a different way. And I think that's why contingency management, it starts out with an extrinsic reward that you're providing people. But what patients tell me as they're in these programs, there's a point in their treatment where they're not continuing to come because of the cash. They're continuing to come because they view themselves differently.
The self-worth.
They view that they are worthy of a better life. And that switch from an extrinsic reward to an intrinsic reward is so critical in people's recovery. And to me, that's why contingency management works. It's because it really engages people, even in active use. It engages them in a way where they can start to change their behavior and start to view themselves differently over time.
Well, I would imagine that dopamine that a certain Dr. Nick gets when a patient says to them, I'm not really coming for the cash anymore. I'm coming for me. I'm coming because my self-worth, that I deserve happiness and I deserve good things. That has to be so meaningful to you.
So meaningful. And yeah, there's more than just dopamine there. There's a little bit of serotonin and oxytocin because I'm feeling really good and feeling connected. And those are other very important neurotransmitters and chemicals that have such a role in our lives.
Well, you just talked over my head, Dr. Nick. So hopefully when we return, you'll tell me what that means, but also what our friends and family can do for those who are living with addiction. That's next on Advancing the Science of Addiction.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
We appreciate you spending time with us here on Advancing the Science of Addiction. I'm Jimmy Alexander here with Dr. Nick Christian. Dr. Nick, I know that so many people, I mean, as you said, which was heartbreaking to me, the highest rate of death between the ages of 15 and 45 is
overdose.
And that means that there's a lot of us who have loved ones, friends, family, or maybe us who are dealing with addiction, and that could be us. So what can friends and family do to help those who are living with addiction and help them support them?
Yeah, that's a question that really hits home for me. I had a close friend while I was living at Community First Village who went through a period where he was doing great with his cocaine use and then started to spiral a little bit with his use. And I really struggled with knowing all that I know about the science and about what treatments work, but feeling so helpless because not all the treatments that we know work are available to people. And two, all the treatments in the world don't matter when you are just with your loved one and you are trying to do what's best for someone. I found that in my caring for my friend, I call him Pops. Caring for Pops was a challenge early on because a lot of people continue to depend on you for things in your life. And feeling like it's a bummer that it feels like you're reinforcing someone when you are just trying to give them love. I find that the whole concept of tough love, it can be problematic at times because I think that love is just love. And I think that if you can make your loved one feel like they are cared and that you are acting in a way that's genuinely because you are concerned about them, that you're concerned about their behavior, you still love them as a person. I think that that's step number one, is making sure that people feel engaged and cared for. And when they are ready for treatment, the reason why it's important to establish that loving, caring relationship is because not everyone's – the window of treatment isn't always open. But when that window does open, you need to make sure that you have a helping hand that's reaching through it to help guide someone through. And when someone is ready for help, we do have SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Association. They have a great treatment locator online where you can type in your zip code, identify what treatment services are available in your community. And so doing some of the recon work of knowing what treatment is available in your community can be huge. And if you're having a really hard time connecting with your loved one, there is a therapy that has been shown to be highly effective in helping people's loved ones cease use and get treatment. I mean, it's called the Community Reinforcement and Family Training Program, the CRAFT training program. And it is that program is combined with the therapy that I mentioned earlier called contingency management, it is incredibly highly effective for individuals. But essentially that the CRAFT, the Community Reinforcement and Family Training Program, can help loved ones learn ways in which their behavior might be impacting their loved one's behavior and really helps start to parse out what are the behaviors that are helpful and what are maybe the behaviors that are less helpful in helping my loved one get treatment.
Dr. Nick, would you say there is one or two or three different things that you would see in somebody that maybe is in your life, obviously, that is dealing with addiction that they might have not have told you about. They have not opened up to you, and that you there's telltale signs. You're like, maybe I there's a tip off.
Yeah. Just to clarify, Jimmy, you're talking about people that I meet in the real world. What are maybe some things where I'm like, I wonder if there might be an addiction?
It could be a loved one. It could be a coworker. It could be just a friend in your life that they have not told you that they may have an addiction or dealing with addiction. But you're like, like two or three things that you're like, uh-oh, we may have a problem.
Yeah.
It could be your child.
That's a very interesting question. I do think that individuals should be in tune. In an ideal world, everyone would be in tune with all of their coworkers and with all of their loved ones to a degree where they feel comfortable being themselves around you. The unfortunate reality is that addiction is a very stigmatized condition. So that often means that people don't feel comfortable talking about what they're going through outside of your relationship with that individual. And some signs, I don't advocate that we shouldn't all be walking around thinking like, does that person have an addiction or not? Does that person have an addiction or not? But some things that might tip you off that, you know what, I wonder if I need to talk to this person. I wonder if I need to listen and ask them how they're doing. Things like if they're not fulfilling their obligations that they previously were fulfilling. If their mood seems different. I am so grateful that we are moving into a new realm where mental health has become a priority, where people feel more comfortable taking days off if they need a mental health day and seeking treatment if they have mental health concerns. I hope that that will continue to manifest in our relationship with our coworkers and with our loved ones. So that we can talk to people about mental health concerns. And so acknowledging, saying to someone, hey, I noticed you don't seem like yourself today. How are things? Those are ways to potentially open the door to hearing what is actually going on in people's lives.
And again, in a non-judgmental way. So
exactly.
Because you don't want anybody to, you know, instantly put their gate up.
Yes.
Yeah. Doc, I know since marijuana has been legalized in a lot of places, I mean, last 10 years, it's just amazing how different the world is for folks who do partake in marijuana. And for the longest time, it was called the gateway drug. Like, oh, boy, you know, if the kid's in the garage smoking weed, by next week, he'll be on cocaine. Is there really a gateway drug, or was that just something that people thought?
It's a very good question that has been explored in many studies, and it's actually a very difficult question to answer because there's just so many factors that go into substance use. We do know that some substances have an inherently higher risk of causing an addiction compared to other substances, and the way that we can study that is looking at, of all people who use a substance, let's take alcohol, for instance. The majority of people in America have tried alcohol. Now, how many of those people develop an alcohol use disorder? It's actually a pretty small percentage compared to the total number of people that have tried alcohol. And so there's if you compare that, though, to, for instance, heroin, heroin is we know that the percentage of people that have tried it compared to the percentage of people who develop a use disorder, it's higher than that of alcohol. Does that mean that the drug alone is scarier, or that it's the molecule that's causing addiction? We actually don't. Like, we think that there's more than just the substance that drives the addictive process. Some other things that create a foundation for potential addictive behaviors down the road, we know that experiencing trauma, adverse childhood events, having an untreated mental illness, having untreated chronic pain, these are all things that people are just seeking relief from, and they're going to turn to whatever they can get their hands on to feel better.
Or sometimes to stop hurting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not even to feel good.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Make the pain go away.
Yeah. And so we know that those things can create the foundation for a potential addiction to develop. There's a lot that goes into the gateway theory as well, because there's also something that we call the social phenomena. Like if you know, so I've done a lot of research and work with people who were once unhoused, and as they transition into housing, what happens in that process? What makes someone more likely to not use drugs versus use drugs after they get housing? And we know that one of the biggest predictors of drug use after you get into housing is, do your housemates or the people that you use or people that you live with, do they use drugs? And that social environment is so important. And I wonder if some of this gateway theory of drug use, if it is actually more a reflection of the social connections that people who use drugs have, as opposed to the substance itself causing you to potentially use other drugs.
The old birds of a feather.
Yes.
And then, you know, do whatever together. Dr. Nick, I want you to tell us about your musicianship and the song that you wrote and performed. And that's coming up next on Advancing the Science of Addiction.
This episode of Advancing the Science of Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
I'm Jimmy Alexander, and this is Advancing the Science of Addiction. And that song that you just heard was by the True Renaissance Man, Is There Anything That You Can't Do? Dr. Nick Christian, tell us about that song.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I've been playing music really since the age of 14. Played in bands all my life, mainly as a bassist and a backup vocalist. And just a couple years ago, there was a call for art that explored themes around the overdose crisis. And I had just recently had an interesting conversation with a patient of mine who had talked about their current use. They were using intravenous opiates, presumed fentanyl. And they likened their use to playing Russian roulette. Because you just don't know what's in the supply. And that really hit home to me, just how difficult it must be now that, drug use may have always been semi-problematic, but it's never been problematic in the way that it is currently, which is one bad batch of your supply and you're dead. And so I wanted to explore that in a song, and it really led me to think about our American exceptionalism in a not so great way. I love our country to death, but there are just a couple of things that we're really good at that is a bummer. One is overdoses. We don't really see that this rate of overdose deaths quite our rate definitely supersedes other countries.
And let's reiterate the stat that you gave out earlier about 15 to 45 year olds.
Yeah, the number one leading cause of death is overdose. That 110,000 people died of an overdose in 2022.
Okay, that's think about whether you're talking about Commander Field. There's like say 90,000 people there. That's 100. Think about more people than would see the Commanders play.
Died in 1 year of an overdose, and so we're exceptional in that regard, and we're also pretty exceptional at gun violence and deaths by guns. And I don't know. I just started thinking the comparing the Russian roulette and gun deaths. It kind of inspired the chorus of this song. It's an American condition. Which is a play on words of American and condition. That man, we found ourselves. We have so much freedom and so many amazing blessings in this country. And freedoms that you don't see in other countries, but for some reason, we are still we're not doing great by some measures. And how can we do better? And so this song was really to kind of put a highlight on that, and also to highlight the metaphor of Russian roulette. In the song, the first verse starts out as someone going to buy something. And they think that they're buying blanks for a gun, but one of them is a bullet. And just imagining someone buying a bag of things, not knowing if it's a real bullet or not, and then playing Russian roulette, and just how that must feel for someone, and exploring that emotion really hit me hard, and still does, to think about the lengths that someone must really, really be suffering in their life to want to play that game, and they're still playing the game. And so what are ways that we can do to help change the game, to help people feel that they have access to treatment,
mm-hmm.
and access to another game, a game that's potentially more recovery-focused, a game that's focused on their health and well-being. And that was kind of the inspiration of the song. And I recorded it myself, which was great. And I have to give a shout out to my fiance who provided a vocal take on there that you hear. She did a great job. And I feel like I haven't really been able to release the song anywhere. So I'm just grateful for the opportunity to talk about it with you, Jimmy.
Dr. Nick, thank you. I know it was heartfelt. And you think about all the musicians that, their life was shortened by addiction. You look at Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, you know, Kurt Cobain with the issues that he was battling with.
And that's just the 27 Club. There's more.
Exactly. And think that was so long ago.
Yeah.
And you think, well, things would have gotten better. But then you hear a stat like you just mentioned. It's like, oh, my gosh. You know, thank God that you guys at NIDA IRP are doing something to help people find a way to recovery. And I know that if you want to take part in a clinical trial that you guys are doing over at NIDA IRP, how can someone go ahead and do that?
Yeah, they should definitely hop on our website. It is researchstudies, that's plural, researchstudies.nida.nih.gov.
And with that, what would someone expect? They call or they go to the website, and what happens? They come the first day and what?
Yeah, there's a lot of different options that we provide on the website. You can either call a number and we'll give you more information. You might be able to find your way to, we do a pre-screener online to see if you might potentially be eligible for some of our studies. But you can expect if you call and leave us a voicemail or no matter what way that you reach out to us, we return to you with a phone call. We sort out whether you might be eligible for our studies.
But let's
or
say
not.
You are eligible.
If you are eligible, you come in and we provide a full health screening for you, inclusive of labs, of an EKG. You see a healthcare provider there. And we really try to provide the community with the service by providing a thorough screening. At the end of that screening day, if you remain eligible for our studies, we end up reaching out to you, and you are compensated for your time in our screening process, as well as compensated for your time in our studies.
Now, your fiance, how'd the two of you meet?
So we actually met through a mutual friend of ours down in Austin.
And so she must be like, oh, he's a doctor. Perfect. I mean, that's pretty impressive in itself.
Actually, quite the opposite. She is a nurse, and she grew up around a lot of distasteful doctors practiced in a so that was actually a mark against me that I'm still working to overcome.
Yes. Well, let me tell you, I'm married to a nurse, and it was a mark against me that I was a broadcaster. So if that counts for anything, I understand that completely. But yeah, I failed to mention, and I wanted to ask you, what would you say that music and art, does that play a role in recovery, would you say?
There actually are a lot of programs that are based around music therapy. And I'm not familiar with all the literature, but I know that just having social connection is so critical to people as they're making lifestyle changes. And if you're a musician, that's such an integral part of your identity. So being around other people who share that identity while not using substances, I think it can be very life-giving to people. It's something, as a musician myself, I was on tour with a country band for a while, and it is just so prevalent to be offered alcohol everywhere you go or even offered drugs.
Offered drugs like you would be water.
Yes. It's very shocking at times. And I think we wonder why we see such high rates of overdose and drug deaths among musicians and creatives. And I think it's we've somewhat normalized it to that that culture. And I find that when I have patients who are musicians, I connect with them on a level that I oftentimes don't connect with other patients, because I think that I understand some of that culture a bit more maybe than someone that hasn't had that lived experience. Still to this day, the friends that I'm the closest with at Community First Village were fellow musicians. And we recorded an album together, and we just grew so close as friends and colleagues, mainly through the music, not so much my role as a doctor.
Well, I'm sure being in that community and being a part of that does help you in your career now. I mean, and helping others. Because I think about, you know, two off the top of my head. When you heard that Tom Petty died of an overdose, you're like, oh my gosh, and Prince. It's like, what? You wouldn't even think that those two people had drug issues. It never entered your mind.
Exactly. Oh, and yeah, people like Chris Cornell, who hadn't been using in so long, and probably it sounds like that may not have been an overdose. But there's just so much mental health concerns that I think happen among people who feel pressured to create.
Absolutely.
And I think we just need, it's something that shouldn't go unnoticed. It's something that we there are programs actually that I have seen, especially in Austin, Texas. That's where I did my internal medicine training. They have programs specifically targeting musicians just because there are so many there. And I think that that's critical. I think it's important to make people feel comfortable seeking help for things that are preventing them from living their best life.
And that's why we're going to do this right now for you. If you are dealing with that or somebody you love, just go to researchstudies.nida.nih.gov. Again, that's researchstudies.nida.nih.gov. I can't thank you enough, Dr. Nick. It was so much fun hanging out with you again, and I appreciate your help and everything that you're doing to help folks. Thank you so much.
It was so great to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you for tuning in once again to Advancing the Science of Addiction, brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Join us again for another insightful episode. Until then, stay informed and take care.